9/11/2002, a ritual for beginning to remember. 9/11/2002, a ritual for beginning to remember, is a production of CLAL, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership, an organization dedicated to bringing people together to address the most challenging questions of contemporary times and Jewish life. For 28 years, CLAL's faculty of rabbis from every denomination and scholars from an array of disciplines have united people across boundaries and developed new resources and new rituals that engage individuals, families, and communities in Jewish life. Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, Vice President of CLAL, will introduce the ritual and be joined by the CLAL faculty, Rabbi Erwin Kula, Rabbi Tzvi Blanchard, Rabbi Steve Greenberg, Dr. Shari Cohen, Dr. Michael Gottsagen, Dr. Robert Rabinowitz, Dr. David Kramer, and Rabbi Daniel Brenner in this production, taped in New York City at the studios of the Jewish Braille Institute.
September 11th, 2002 is going to be very hard. It should be. For many of us, it represents the most serious attack on America and all that for which it stands that any of us has ever experienced. The Midrash teaches us that it is impossible to make sense of a tragedy when one is very close to it, but that even when the logic of an event eludes us, we must remember it. Since the story of God remembering Noah after 40 days of floating in his ark, remembering has been the path that both honors the past and returns us to life. So how do we remember September 11th? How do we access our traditions to help us remember this human tragedy in a deeply Jewish way? How do we confront this American Yahrzeit? Yahrzeit, the anniversary of a loss, can be as much about shaping the future as it is about remembering the past. Not only do we recall what we have lost, we actually imagine how the power of a person's life, sometimes called their soul, can continue to grow. According to certain rabbinic Kabbalistic traditions, the Yahrzeit actually becomes a life-affirming moment in which the soul has yet another chance to ascend higher into the heavens. For us, it can be a moment in which we have yet another chance to realize the vision and the values of who and what have come before. The traditional Jewish cycle of mourning practices helps us to evoke the moment of loss, to remember who and what have been lost, and finally, to move forward. In that spirit, we have constructed a ritual in three parts. The first part returns us to September 11th, 2001, and the days and weeks following. It draws on sounds as old as the notes of the shofar and as contemporary as the wail of a police siren. It combines prophetic words from thousands of years ago with news and cell phone conversations from the day of the attacks. The second part of this ritual is about remembering. Again, drawing on texts, both ancient and modern, we ask ourselves, whom have we lost? What has been taken from us? How has our world been diminished? Each of these sections is shaped by perhaps the oldest text of Jewish national destruction, the Book of Echa, Lamentations. The word Echa is actually a question. Two, really. How could this happen? And where are you? Questions to which each of us returns over and over again. In the spirit of Echa, we invite you to struggle with these questions as a way to build lasting memory without despair and imagine the future without naivete. That is precisely the goal of the third part of this ritual, which helps to move through our pain and prepare us for the next phases of life. Here we confront the new vulnerabilities that have become a regular feature of our lives. We also experience the depth of our commitment to life and our intense desire to move forward in safety and in security. Concluding with Tfilat HaDerech, the Traveler's Prayer, we affirm that the journey will continue and that we will help each other along the way.
Tikia. Tirua. Shivarim. Tikia gedola. Echa yashva vadad, ha'ir rabati am, haita kealmana, rabati vagoyim, sarati ba medinot, haita lamas.
This just in, you are looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center. CNN Center right now is just beginning to work on this story.
Ein la minachem mi kolohaveha kol re'eha vagaduva hayula le'oivim.
There are more explosions further down the building. It was calm until we came on the air now, but I'm now looking up at this building, and there is smoke billowing from the very top, but then there is a fire and an explosion about 20 stories further down. I was at the base of the building when it happened. There was one huge bang, and the building physically shook. Then another two or three bangs, and the building again shook, and people came screaming past me.
At the moment, it looks as if both buildings are on fire.
Clearly, the thing is out of control. As I say, there is smoke billowing out from further and further down the building, and people are simply moving back. They don't know what has happened. Initially, the assumption was that it was a bomb. People have been coming past me now saying, no, it was an aircraft which hit the building. More than that, I cannot say, apart from to tell you that people here are very, very frightened. People are crying. People are shaking. They've stopped running away from the building. They are now walking away. There is moisture raining down from a clear sky. I only presume that comes from the disaster which is going on above me as I speak.
Galta Yuda me oni umero vavoda hi yashva vagoyim lomatza manoach korodefea hisiguha ben hamitzarim.
And then we saw smoke coming out, and everybody started running out, and we saw the plane on the other side of the building, and there was smoke everywhere, and people are jumping out the windows. Over there, they're jumping out the windows, I guess, because they're trying to save themselves. I don't know. And I don't know. Everybody just doesn't know where to go. They won't let... Everything is blocked off. You can't even... They're telling us to get out, but there's nowhere to go. And then I heard that another plane's hit. And if you go over by there, you can see the people jumping out the window. They're jumping out the window right now. Oh, my God.
Darchei Tzion avilot mipli ba'ei mo'ed kol she'areha shomemim kohaneha nenachim betuloteha nugot vehi marla.
And six trucks and three battalions are responding from various staging points. Are you ready to write the identities?
Yeah, go ahead, Matt.
All right, you're going to get engine 258, 259, 325, 262, 312, 261, 260, engine 68, 35, 50, 64, 94, and 83. I gave you three chiefs, the 4-5, the 4-6, and the 4-9.
Zechor Adonai mehayalanu habita rei et herpateinu.
There has just been a huge explosion. We can see a billowing smoke rising, and I'll tell you that I can't see that second tower, but there was a cascade of sparks and fire, and now this, it looks almost like a mushroom cloud explosion, this huge billowing smoke in the second tower. This was the second of the two towers hit. And I cannot see behind that smoke, obviously, as you can either. The first tower in front has not changed, and we see this extraordinary and frightening scene.
Nachalateinu nefcha lezarim, bateinu lenochrim.
Time ago, there was a huge plume of smoke which continues to rise from the west side of the Pentagon. The building is currently being evacuated, and police and emergency units are, of course, responding.
We have a report now that a large plane crashed this morning north of the Somerset County Airport, which is in western Pennsylvania, not too terribly far from Pittsburgh, about 80 miles or so, Boeing 767 jet.
Yitomim hayinu ve'en av imoteinu ke'alemanot.
The second tower, the front tower, the top portion of which is collapsing. Good Lord. There are no words. You can see large pieces of the building falling. You can see the smoke rising. You can see a portion of the side of the building now just being covered on the right side, as I look at it, covered in smoke. This is just a horrific scene and a horrific moment.
Meimeinu bechesev shatinu, eitzeinu bimechir yavo.
I want to reassure the American people that the full resources of the federal government are working to assist local authorities to save lives and to help the victims of these attacks. Make no mistake, the United States will hunt down and punish those responsible for these cowardly acts. The resolve of our great nation is being tested, but make no mistake, we will show the world that we will pass this test.
Al tzavareinu Nihiradafnu Yaganu Velohunachlanu.
Honey, something terrible is happening. I don't think I'm going to make it. I love you. Take care of the children. Lori, I love you. I'm in the World Trade Center, and the building was hit by something. I don't know if I'm going to get out, but I love you very much. I hope I'll see you later. Bye. Mommy, the building's on fire. There's smoke coming through the walls. I can't breathe. I love you, Mommy. Goodbye. Hey, Jules, it's Brian. I'm on a plane and it's hijacked, and it doesn't look good. I just wanted to let you know that I love you, and I hope to see you again. If I don't, please have fun in life and live your life the best you can. Know that I love you, and no matter what, I'll see you again. Liz, it's me, Dan. My building has been hit. I made it to the 78th floor. I'm okay, but will remain here to help evacuate people. See you soon. Elizabeth, I love you 1,000 times over and over and over again. Please tell Emmy I love her and take good care of her. Whatever decisions you make in your life, I need you to be happy. And I will respect any decisions that you make. I will always love you.
The Diameter of the Bomb by Yehuda Amichai.
The diameter of the bomb was 30 centimeters, and the diameter of its effective range about 7 meters, with 4 dead and 11 wounded. And around these, in a larger circle of pain and time, 2 hospitals are scattered and 1 graveyard. But the young woman who was buried in the city she came from, at a distance of more than 100 kilometers, enlarges the circle considerably, and the solitary man mourning her death at the distant shores of a country far across the sea includes the entire world in the circle. And I won't even mention the crying of orphans that reaches up to the throne of God and beyond, making a circle with no end and no God.
Portraits from the collected Portraits of Grief from the New York Times. Eli Chilu. Fluent in Arabic, Hebrew, and English, Eli Chalou, 23, moved easily among the diverse communities to which his languages gave him access. He spoke Arabic at home, of course. He moved here with his family from Damascus, Syria, when he was 14. At his new job at the New York State Department of Taxation and Finance in the World Trade Center, he spoke Arabic with his Egyptian colleagues, who got a kick out of him. Mr. Chalou was not Muslim. He was a Syrian Jew who learned Hebrew at the yeshiva he attended in Brooklyn. America was a country he wanted to wrap his future around. He was always in a rush, determined to cram every moment with English studies and other courses. He was so disciplined that he allotted himself only 15 minutes of television at night. His efforts were beginning to pay off. He had just graduated with near-perfect grades from Long Island University, a member of the Honor Society, and voted by the faculty the most outstanding accounting student of 2001. Industrious, yes, but enormously sunny and engaging as well. Whatever you asked him, he would do, and whatever you wouldn't ask, he would volunteer to do, said a supervisor at work, Eddie Yeager. He was an unbelievably nice kid.
Evan H. Gillette. Sherry Partridge, a native New Yorker, had been searching for the right man for years, and at 39 she found Evan Hunter Gillette. They met on the internet. "We just really hit it off," recalled Ms. Partridge, a publicist working downtown. Mr. Gillette, 40, was a vice president at Sandler O'Neill & Partners. After a few dates last year, the two moved in together and spent weekends in Canada, Vermont, Washington, and Monticello, Virginia. "We did a lot of bed and breakfast," she said. "We walked hand in hand, lay on the grass, and took it all in." A wedding was in the offing. The couple roamed the streets of Manhattan looking for the right rings and talking about babies. "We were very, very happy," she said. Before the attack, Ms. Partridge says, she had a dim prescience of what was to come. "Sometimes I woke up in the middle of the night and had this gripping fear that he might die," she said. "I would tell him, 'Please don't die, please don't die,' and he would tell me, 'I'll never leave you.'"
Telmo Alvear. At 25, Telmo Alvear, who emigrated from Ecuador as a teenager, was assembling the pieces of a good life. His son, Stephen, had just turned one. His wife, Blanca, was studying computerized accounting at a Midtown technical college. And in August 2001, he quit a busboy job to become a waiter at Windows on the World for much higher tips. He liked serving fancy meals and was beginning to learn about wine. Off duty, Mr. Alvear was usually at home with his family in Queens, watching soccer on television or cooking dinners of seafood or pasta for relatives and friends. On weekend afternoons, he joined his team at Flushing Meadows, Corona Park, for some hard-hitting volleyball. When he and his friends went dancing with their wives and girlfriends, he would make a point of dancing with as many of the women as he could. Mr. Alvear was assigned to the night shift at Windows on the World, but on Monday, another waiter told him he could not make the breakfast shift, and Mr. Alvear agreed to cover for him. The friend promised to return the favor soon.
Stephen J. Bates. Although Stephen J. Bates liked the solitude of athletic competitions like running, swimming, and bicycling, he was a team player, period. That was why he worked for 18 years as a New York City firefighter. The lieutenant liked the way firefighters relied on one another while sticking to their vows to save lives and put out fires. Most of all, Lieutenant Bates liked the automatic brotherhood of the job. It gave him the family he always wanted. "His mother died when he was 15, and he was estranged from his father," said his girlfriend Joan Pawalski. "He frequently took family-style dinners with the firefighters at his station house, Engine Company 235 in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. He liked cooking family dinners for the gang. Sauerbraten was his best dish." The other members of his family were two big dogs who lived in the home that he shared with Ms. Pawalski in Glendale, Queens. Samantha, 8, a 105-pound yellow Labrador retriever, and Norton, 8, an 85-pound mutt. "He called them his babies," Ms. Pawalski said. "Sometimes the four of us would sleep together in our queen-size bed. That was a squeeze, considering that Lieutenant Bates, 42, was a big man, standing exactly 6 feet, and weighing 235 pounds.
David's Lament from 2 Samuel, chapter 1, verses 19 through 25.
Thy beauty, O Israel, is slain upon your high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. You, mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. Saul and Jonathan were loved and dear in their lives, and in their deaths they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet, with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of battle?
Stories of Heroism and Resolve from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, New York Newsday, and the New York Times.
This is an account of an event that occurred on September 11, 2001, when four men boarded United Airlines Flight 93, intending to blow up the aircraft full of passengers along with themselves. The passengers, knowing that they would lose their own lives, overpowered the terrorist hijackers. The entire aircraft and its passengers were destroyed. From the back of Flight 93, Cece Lyles finally reached her husband, Lorne. "Babe, my plane's been hijacked," she said. "Huh? Stop joking," he said. "No, babe, I wouldn't joke like that. I love you. Tell the boys I love them." The pair prayed. In the background, Lorne Lyles could hear what he now believes was the sound of men planning a counterattack. "They're getting ready to force their way into the cockpit," she told him. When he had finished talking with Lisa Jefferson, finished relaying his love for his family, finished praying the psalm that asked for green pastures and still waters, Todd Beamer put down the phone, still connected with the outside world. "Are you guys ready? Let's roll," he said. Honor Wainio was still on the line with her stepmother. "I need to go," she said. "They're getting ready to break into the cockpit. I love you. Goodbye." "Everyone's running to first class," Andy Bradshaw told her husband. "I've got to go. Bye." Cece Lyles let out a scream. "They're doing it! They're doing it! They're doing it!" she said. Lorne Lyles heard a scream. Then his wife said something he couldn't understand. Then the line went dead. 45 seconds after telling Supervisor Dennis Fritz to evacuate the Johnston Tower, Cleveland Air Traffic Control phoned again. They said to disregard. The aircraft had turned to the south, and they lost radar contact with him. It was 10:06 a.m. Fritz and Controller Thomas Hull studied the horizon to the south. They couldn't see a thing.
Will Jimeno, 32, was one of the last two people to be pulled out of the World Trade Center alive. Jimeno was a rookie with 9 months on the job when he left the Port Authority bus terminal with a group of four other officers and headed for the burning trade towers. They were putting on their helmets and air packs in the mall area near the huge globe, preparing to enter Tower 1 when Tower 2 collapsed, caving in the ground beneath their feet. Two of the officers with him, Antonio Rodriguez and Christopher Amoroso, were killed. Jimeno, Dominic Pizzullo, and Sergeant John McLaughlin were buried 20 feet down, Jimeno said. McLaughlin's legs and the entire left side of Jimeno's body were crushed by falling debris. Pizzullo, Jimeno's classmate from the police academy, was able to dig himself out. He went to Jimeno and was trying to dig his friend out when Tower 1 collapsed, causing a concrete wall to collapse onto Pizzullo. With his dying words, Pizzullo told Jimeno, "Will, don't forget me. Just remember I died saving you guys." With that, Pizzullo shot his gun through an opening in what Jimeno said was a last-ditch effort to say, "Hey, we're here." Pizzullo then slumped over and died. While he was pinned, Jimeno said the thought ran through his mind that he wouldn't make it out of that hole, that he would never see again his wife, Allison, their daughter, Bianca, or the daughter who was due to be born in a few months. He told McLaughlin that if he didn't make it, then tell his wife that he wanted their newborn to be named Olivia, a name he happened to like. About 10 hours after he was first buried, rescue workers found Jimeno. It took another 3 hours to free him, and it took nearly 3 times as long to free McLaughlin, who spent a total of 22 hours buried. Jimeno spent 3 months in the hospital and rehabilitation center and now undergoes intensive therapy 3 times a week. His daughter, Olivia, was born on his birthday, November 26th.
This is the story of John Paul DeVito, chief operating officer of May Davis Group, a small investment bank located at One World Trade Center, and Harry Ramos, the head trader with the same firm. They were two ordinary people among the thousands caught in the World Trade Center, and like countless others, they were thrust into chaos and forced to make extraordinary choices. One chose to lead his own staff out of the building, troubled as he did so by the thought that he was abandoning his duty to safeguard the firm, even answer the phones. The other chose to stop and try to save the life of a stranger. Today, one is at home, ecstatic about life itself, and wondering how he could have dreamed of staying at his office command post instead of guiding his staff down the stairs to safety. He is, he says, a different person, able to recognize the courage and selflessness in regular people. The other is missing in the rubble, memorialized in the constant tremble in the voices of his family and friends. DeVito was just sitting down to some paperwork and a second cup of coffee after meeting with a client. Ramos, just back from a week's leave after the death of his mother-in-law, was exchanging greetings with his assistant. Then, at 8:48 a.m., their building, One World Trade Center, lurched violently like a ship in high seas. Mr. DeVito was nearly knocked off his chair. Mr. Ramos braced himself in a doorway. Neither Mr. DeVito nor Mr. Ramos realized there was a gaping gash in the glass and steel just above them, where a Boeing 767 had slammed into the building. All they knew was that their office was filling with smoke. Mr. DeVito ran for the elevator bank. He opened the door to an incomprehensible sight. Where there had once been other offices, there was now just a huge void, full of fire and smoke. "What am I doing?" Mr. DeVito suddenly asked himself. "Get back in there, get the employees." He ran back into his office suite. Some thought that they should stay. Others agreed to leave but wanted to gather their things. But which things? What to take down 87 floors? Everybody made for the stairs except for Hong Zhu, an investment banker, who was frozen with fear. He told the others he would wait for help. Mr. Ramos cajoled him to the stairwell door. Then Mr. DeVito had misgivings. Should he lead his employees down to safety or stay? He decided to take the lead in going down. The others formed a human chain behind him, each putting a hand on the shoulder of the person in front, and descended into the gathering smoke. Back on the 53rd floor, Mr. Zhu was trailing far behind. He saw his firm's head trader, Mr. Ramos, leaning over a very heavy man named Victor, who seemed unable to move. Mr. Zhu stopped, wanting to help. "Why don't you lean on both of our shoulders?" Mr. Zhu suggested. They helped Victor to his feet and struggled with him down one flight. Then Mr. Zhu saw that the elevator appeared to be working. They descended to the 44th floor, but there it stopped. They started struggling down the stairs again. When Mr. Ramos went ahead to scout, Victor cried out in fear. "Harry, please help," he begged. "Don't worry, we're not leaving you," Mr. Ramos said. On the 39th floor, Mr. Ramos spotted an open door, a credit union. They decided to go in and rest. Just then, they felt the building shake again. They jumped back onto their feet and trudged down to the 36th floor, but then Victor gave up. "I can't move my legs anymore," he said. "Don't move your legs," ordered Mr. Zhu. "Sit down and move your butt." He sat and tried bumping down step by step, but soon gave up again. Another fireman, hurling curses, told them to leave Victor and get out of the building. Mr. Zhu continued down, but heard Mr. Ramos behind him saying, "Victor, don't worry. I'm with you." Below on the plaza, Mr. DeVito had by then emerged with what was left of his group. His employees thanked him, but he felt so bad about not knowing where everybody was that he considered himself unworthy. Then a roar. the neighboring 2 World Trade Center was collapsing. Soon afterward, the other tower toppled, and no one has seen Mr. Ramos since. As everyone on the ground began screaming and fleeing, Mr. DeVito was engulfed by smoke and dust. Mr. DeVito was glad to be alive, glad he had decided to help others to safety, thrilled to have watched other ordinary people performing simple acts of courage under tremendous pressure. "If you had seen what it was like in that stairway, you'd be proud," he said later. "There was no gender, no race, no religion. It was everyone, unequivocally, helping each other." In the days since, Mae Davis employees have spent their energies checking in with one another, meeting at homes to exchange stories. Most of all, they have been calling the city's hospitals and checking the lists of Trade Center survivors, trying to find Mr. Ramos.
Psalm 23.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. You allow me to lie down in green pastures. You lead me beside still waters, you restore my soul. You lead me in right paths for your name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of death's shadow, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord my whole life long.
A meditation before saying Kaddish, adapted from the words of Shai Agnon.
God cares for each individual life. God mourns, as it were, each person. When a person dies, God's own name is diminished, God's own sanctity lessened. God's kingdom experiences a terrible vacancy. God suffers, as it were, just as the human mourner suffers. When we recite Kaddish, we offer God consolation for this loss. We say Yitgadal, your name has been diminished. May it be magnified. Yitgadash, your sanctity has been lessened. May it be increased. Yamlich Malchutei, your kingdom has suffered a sudden loss. May it reign eternally. Before reciting the Kaddish, let us reflect on our loss and the source of all growth and goodness. Let us reflect on praising God who stands beside us as a mourner and who also is the promise on which we build tomorrow.
Yitgadal v'yitgadash shemei rabah, v'yolma divra chirutei, v'yamlich malchutei, v'chayechon v'yomechon v'chayei d'chol beit Yisrael, b'agala u'vizman kari v'imru amen. Yehei shemei rabah mevorach le'olam ulomei olmaya, Yitbarach, v'yishtabach, v'yitpa'ar, v'yitromam, v'yitnase, v'yitadar, v'yitale, v'yitalal, shmei d'kudusha, b'richu. Le'ila min kol birchata v'shirata, tushbechata v'nechemata, damiran be'alma v'imru amen. Yehei shlama rabah min shemaya, V'chayim aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael v'imru amen. Oseh shalom b'imromav, hu ya'aseh shalom aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael v'imru amen.
An excerpt from E.B. White's essay entitled Here is New York, first published in 1949.
The subtlest change in New York is something people don't speak much about, but that is on everyone's mind. The city, for the first time in its long history, is destructible. A single flight of planes, no bigger than a wedge of geese, can quickly end this island fantasy, burn the towers, crumble the bridges, turn the underground passages into lethal chambers, cremate the millions. The intimation of mortality is part of New York now, in the sound of jets overhead, in the black headlines of the latest edition. All dwellers in cities must live with the stubborn fact of annihilation. In New York, the fact is somewhat more concentrated because of the concentration of the city itself, and because, of all targets, New York has a certain clear priority. In the mind of whatever perverted dreamer might loose the lightning, New York must hold a steady, irresistible charm. It used to be that the Statue of Liberty was the signpost that proclaimed New York and translated it for all the world. Today, liberty shares the role with death. Along the East River, from the raised slaughterhouses of Turtle Bay, as though in a race with the spectral flight of planes, men are carving out the permanent headquarters of the United Nations, the greatest housing project of them all. In its stride, New York takes on one more interior city to shelter, this time, all governments and to clear the slum called war. New York is not a capital city. It is not a national capital or a state capital, but it is by way of becoming the capital of the world. This race between the destroying planes and the struggling parliament of man, it sticks in all our heads. The city at last perfectly illustrates both the universal dilemma and the general solution. This riddle in steel and stone is at once the perfect target and the perfect demonstration of nonviolence, of racial brotherhood, this lofty target scraping the skies and meeting the destroying planes halfway, home of all people and all nations, capital of everything, housing the deliberations by which the planes are to be stayed and their errand forestalled. A block or two west of the new city of man in Turtle Bay, there is an old willow tree that presides over an interior garden. It is a battered tree, long-suffering and much climbed, held together by strands of wired, but beloved of those who know it. In a way, it symbolizes the city. Life under difficulties, growth against odds, sap rise in the midst of concrete, and the steady reaching for the sun. Whenever I look at it nowadays and feel the cold shadow of the plains, I think, this must be saved, this particular thing, this very tree. If it were to go, all would go. This city, this mischievous and marvelous monument, which not to look upon would be like death.
A Piyut, a Medieval Liturgical Prayer by Abraham Hazan Gurondi. Hide not your eyes forever, Lord, but see our deep distress which pours out to you, while destroyers scourge our flesh with cruel blows. A year of sorrows draws to a close. Draw us up from the pit of misery. Break the prison chains and make us free. Display your wonders, driving out the violent forces. Gather your flock and guard us from our foes. A year of sorrow draws to a close. Your precious vine, whose clusters ruthless men have stripped, trampled on by beasts, lift again. Even now, the buds of hope are opening. A year of sorrows draws to a close. Be strong, endure. Joy shall return and wrong shall cease. Trust still the rock, whose covenant is sure and whose paths are peace. You shall be led to a restored Zion. In the approaching year, you shall see such a day. Begin, New Year, and bring that joyous day. Tefilat HaDerech, the Traveler's Prayer.
Yehi Ratzon, may it be your will, Lord our God, to lead us on the way of peace, and guide and direct our steps in peace, so that you bring us happily to our destination, safe and sound. Save us from danger on the way. Give us good grace, kindness, and favor both in your eyes and in the eyes of all whom we may meet. Hear this our prayer for you are a God who listens to the heart's supplication and communion. Blessed are you, Lord our God, who hears prayer.